I'm going to be meeting with Chairman Kim in the not too distant future.
A new trade deal and continuing diplomacy in the Korean Peninsula. It's Tuesday, September 25th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, a power shift in the Maldives, celebrating women's voting rights in New Zealand, music to heal wounds of war, dying turtles, and looking inside the vehicle vault. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Amid continuing trade tensions with China, President Donald Trump has just announced a new trade deal with South Korea, signing the agreement with South Korean President Moon Jae-in on the sidelines of the annual United Nations General Assembly in New York.
The new U.S.-Korea agreement includes significant improvements to reduce our trade deficit and to expand opportunities to export American products to South Korea. In other words, we are now going to start sending products to South Korea. These outcomes give the finest American-made automobiles, innovative medicines, and agricultural crops much better access to Korean markets.
President Trump also confirmed he would meet again with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
We have an agreement to work out another summit, and we look forward to doing that. I'm going to be meeting with Chairman Kim in the not-too-distant future. The location is being worked on, the time is being worked on, and we'll be announcing it.
Earlier, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the U.N. Security Council remains united in maintaining economic sanctions on North Korea until it finally denuclearizes.
We have our eyes wide open. There is a long ways to go to get Chairman Kim to live up to the commitment that he made to President Trump and indeed to the demands of the world in the U.N. Security Council resolutions to get him to fully denuclearize. But our team is fully engaged in this. There are lots of conversations taking place. There's lots of work being done. It isn't all visible to the public, but we are fully engaged in the process. We understand the objective, and economic sanctions will remain in place until we get there.
Joshua Pollack is a senior research associate at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. He tells VOA at the last summit in Singapore in June, a broad statement was reached on peace, improved relations, and the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, but little substance and no timeline on how to achieve those goals.
So the next step seems to be to work out some kind of a framework or sequencing for these steps to decide what they mean and what order they will unfold in. Failing that, there might just be an exchange of a few measures here and there. What was troubling until recently is there was not much indication that negotiations were underway to try to straighten these details out, at least not until the Pyongyang summit. At that point, Secretary Pompeo issued a statement saying that Chairman Kim's commitments at the Pyongyang summit with President Moon were sufficient to get talks going again. At that point, he invited the North Korean foreign minister to come to New York. So it seems that something is now getting moving, and if that process leads anywhere, then it stands to reason they would have a second summit and try to walk away with a more detailed outcome than they got the first time.
Secretary of State Pompeo has been careful not to comment on whether the United States would consider a declaration on formally ending the Korean War, which the North has been seeking as a sign of reduced U.S. hostility. Pollack was asked what concessions the United States might put forth and what the North would be willing to accept.
Judging by what South Korean President Moon said after the Pyongyang summit, the North Koreans are indeed interested in an end-of-war declaration. We've seen mixed signals on what the North Koreans would expect that to accomplish, whether it would create grounds for a further demand that the United States withdraw its troops. That's something that President Moon has assured the world that the North Koreans are not seeking at this time and do not consider to be the natural consequence of an end-of-war declaration. This is a bit ambiguous, though, because think tankers who have visited Pyongyang have preferred the opposite in their foreign ministry conversations. So we don't really know what the North Koreans expect that declaration to contain or to do. I suspect that the United States would be happy to make some kind of declaration about peace, as long as it does not commit us to anything and there remain steps to be taken, simply because you don't want to give up what has clearly become a bargaining chip until you get an equally irrevocable commitment from the other side.
Joshua Pollack said a meeting between the North Korean foreign minister and Pompeo on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly would be a significant signal the two sides are ready to re-engage following the abrupt cancellation last August of Pompeo's planned trip to Pyongyang. As for denuclearization, Pollack said he believes the North is prepared to do a lot, citing its recent offer to close down its Yongbyon nuclear complex, but only if the U.S. takes certain steps in response. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. Trump returns to UN a year after Rocket Man speech. The U.S. and China exchange new rounds of tariffs and trade war. Amnesty International demands China reveal fate of detained ethnic Muslims. Kwong remembered as low-key functionary close to country's police organs. Youth optimism higher in low-income countries. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Opposition lawmaker Ibrahim Mohamed Soleh has declared victory in Sunday's presidential election in the Indian Ocean island nation of the Maldives, although incumbent Yameen Abdul Gayoom has not conceded as of early Monday. With almost all the votes counted, Soleh led with more than 58% of the vote. But the Election Commission said it would not release results until Saturday. The 56-year-old Soleh became the Maldivian Democratic Party's standard-bearer after party leader and former president Mohamed Nasheed went into exile in Sri Lanka.
This is a moment of happiness. This is a moment of hope. This is a moment of history. For many of us, this has been a difficult journey. A journey that has led to a prison cell or years in exile. It's been a journey that led to a complete politicization and breakdown of public institutions. It's been a journey that has ended at the ballot box because the people willed it. The will of people has spoken, and it has spoken decisively for change.
Mr. Yameen imposed a state of emergency in February to overturn a Supreme Court decision to throw out the convictions of nine opposition leaders, including Nasheed, the country's first democratically elected president. Daniel Brewster is a visiting fellow at the Strategic and Defense Studies Center at the Australian National University. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the election result was remarkable.
And I don't think I've seen anyone predicting it. It was assumed, I think, by everyone watching the election that it was going to be a rigged election, and that would have been very much consistent with Yameen's past practice.
What was the message sent by the voters?
Well, I think it's probably a little bit too early to see what exactly was the biggest driving forces. Certainly from an international perspective, the population of the Maldives seems to have decisively rejected Yameen's move towards being a strong man and authoritarianism and against democracy. The big question, I think, is to what extent the China factor played a role in this victory, and I think we'll have to look at that in coming days.
What do you mean by that?
The current president, or the president who we believe has lost this election, was seen to have become very, very close to China over the last 5 years, including incurring significant indebtedness to China. And there was a view that he was really China's man in the region.
What is this going to do for human rights in the Maldives?
You can only assume that the new government will be far more liberal and more democratically inclined compared with the old one. The new government, the Maldivian Democratic Party, was formed around a little less than 20 years ago and contested the country's first democratic elections in the early 2000s. And the period in which the MDP ruled was seen as much more of a liberal and democratic regime compared with any other governments.
Is this good news for Sri Lanka and India?
It's certainly good news for India and, in fact, good news for the United States and Australia in terms of seeing China's influence in the region rather limited. I have to say, you have to see this election result in the context of a series of election results in countries like Sri Lanka and Myanmar, and more recently in Malaysia, when democratic elections turned out regimes that were becoming authoritarian and being seen as very, very close to China. And, you know, you could easily see this as part of potentially a bit of a regional reaction to some of the practices of China in the region.
In a statement, the U.S. congratulated the people of the Maldives for peacefully raising their democratic voices to determine the future of their country. It urged calm and respect for the will of the people. Happening now in Asia, Indian authorities have issued a yellow alert for the southern state of Kerala, where monsoon rains are expected to continue into the week. Many states are experiencing flash floods, with some airlifting their citizens to safety. Stay up to date with VOA and VOA 60 online. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thank you for joining us. New Zealand has marked the 125th anniversary of a historic move to give women the vote. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports New Zealand was the first country in the world to enact suffrage for women.
Jacinda Ardern, New Zealand's third female prime minister, said the nation's 19th century fight for economic independence and equal rights was still continuing. The gender pay gap in the South Pacific nation is on average 10%, although for working mothers it's about 17%, a pay difference known as the motherhood penalty. Women are also underrepresented in some senior corporate positions. Among New Zealand's top 50 listed companies, female executives make up just a fifth of directors. In September 1893, New Zealand passed an Electoral Act that gave women over the age of 21 the right to vote in parliamentary elections. Schools, theatres, museums and libraries have hosted events commemorating the world-first legislation and discussions about how to achieve greater equality. In Parliament, Prime Minister Ardern praised the campaigners who'd brought about fundamental change all those years ago.
First and foremost, a tribute to the woman who led the change, to Kate Sheppard, to Margaret Sievewright, to the 25,000 women who signed the petition in 1893. I move that this House mark the 125th anniversary of New Zealand women becoming the first in the world to win the right to vote and celebrate the contribution of women to New Zealand's democracy, past, present and future.
A union representing public service workers in New Zealand has held an equal pay strike, demanding an end to wage discrimination. The centre-left Ardern government, which came into power a year ago, has also this week brought in new laws designed to make it easier for female employees to make claims for equal pay. About 40% of New Zealand lawmakers are women, but fewer than a third of government ministers are female. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, using music to combat war. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
The This news from VOA Asia. Three Indonesians have been arrested on suspicion of animal trafficking after Malaysian authorities foiled an effort to smuggle in more than 400 animals from the Indonesian island of Sumatra, according to customs officials. You can freely visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the consequences of Afghanistan's increasingly deadly war are weighing the heaviest on the nation's civilians. But violence and social pressures have not deterred members of the country's nascent orchestra of mostly young girls from using music to heal wounds and promote women's rights in the strictly conservative Muslim society, as we hear from Ayaz Gul in Islamabad.
The Afghan orchestra known as Zohra was founded in 2014 as part of the Afghanistan National Institute of Music. Suicide bombings are routine in Kabul, but students and trainers are not losing hope and regularly rehearse and learn new lessons at the city's only institute.
Yes, I'm so hopeful because we need to stand up and we need to open the door for other Afghan girls. Because if everybody stay at home, so no one be to present to camp and to fight for their rights.
Nagin Khpalwak is the first female conductor of the ensemble in a country where women have borne the brunt of decades of hostilities.
It's a symbol of today's Afghanistan and Afghanistan of tomorrow. In this ensemble, you can see different ethnic groups from Afghanistan, boys and girls. It's hope for the future.
Musicologist Ahmed Nasir Sarmast heads the institute, and he is also the founder of the Zohra Orchestra. Despite the many challenges, he says, the enrollment of students has consistently grown, and more parents are bringing their children to the institute to study music.
I strongly believe without arts and culture there cannot be security. And we're using the soft power of music to make a small contribution to bringing peace and stability in Afghanistan, and at the same time using this beautiful, if I can call it weapon, beautiful weapon, to transform our community.
Yeah, it is too challenging because every day when you are going in the street with your instrument to the school and they're saying bad words to you, and if you are giving a concert in public, they're telling the bad words for you, like you're a musician and you the bad words that you know for the musician. So, but we are not caring about this.
The Zohra Orchestra has traveled to many countries and performed there. This month, the group visited for the first time neighboring Pakistan, which still hosts millions of Afghan refugees. Some of the members of the Afghan orchestra were born and raised in the refugee camps.
We strongly believe in the healing power of music. We're using the healing power of music to look after the wounds of the Afghan people as well as the Pakistani people. We're here with the message of peace, brotherhood, and freedom.
Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
This news from VOA Asia. Campaigning for the upcoming presidential election has begun in Indonesia. Opinion polls show President Joko Widodo fares well with many Indonesians, but he faces a challenge over his economic record with the currency at a two-decade low. Always popular online is VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, plastic pollution floating in our seas is creating huge environmental hazards, polluting our oceans and killing animals like seabirds and marine life. VOA's Deborah Block tells us of a new study which says young turtles in particular are at a higher risk of dying from eating ocean-borne plastic because it doesn't take a lot of plastic to kill them.
Sea turtles are found swimming in the oceans from the Horn of Africa to the Great Barrier Reef. So are huge amounts of plastic waste. It's especially hazardous for sea turtles, who can die from eating the plastic, which they mistake for food, says Hassan Mohammed with the World Wildlife Fund in Kenya.
They think that plastic is a jellyfish. When they eat plastic, it gets into their stomach and causes death. And when there is a lot of plastic around hatching sites, the turtles are not able to lay eggs. So when baby turtles are hatched, they are unable to reach the ocean due to too much plastic that is in their way and blocks them.
A new study published in the journal Scientific Reports says younger turtles, in particular, are at higher risk of dying from ingesting even small pieces of plastic. The research included analyzing the cause of death for turtles that washed up on Australian beaches. On the island of Lamu, off the coast of Kenya, efforts are underway to save the sea turtles. As with other turtle breeding sites, their numbers are declining due to climate change, overfishing, poaching, and the destruction of their nesting grounds. The Lamu Marine Conservation Trust compensates fishermen who hand over turtles caught in their nets, which are later tagged and released back into the ocean.
We have released almost 1,000 adult turtles and 90,000 juvenile turtles, the little baby turtles.
It's just another one of the small steps researchers and scientists are taking worldwide to save endangered sea turtles before it's too late. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
Moving to Los Angeles, California, where inside a hidden vault is a treasure trove of cars from around the world. It's the collection of the Peterson Automotive Museum, and it's now open to the public. As VOA's Faith Lapidus narrates the story by Faiza El-Masri, visiting the vault is like traveling back in time, exploring the history of automaking.
If you're interested in cars, this is where you want to be. It's not a big garage or a dealer showroom. It's the underground Peterson Automotive Museum's vault. Here are hundreds of the world's most iconic vehicles, cars, trucks, and motorcycles, representing over 120 years of automotive history.
Like any other museum, we cannot possibly display all the artifacts we own. We own over 300 cars, and we have more than another 100 on loan to us. So we have quite a treasure trove, but we wanted people to be able to see those too.
So the museum has begun offering guided tours for visitors who want to learn more about global car culture. The cars in the vault come from around the world, and from the beginnings of the auto industry. There's the 1900 Classic that Bob Hope had built for John Wayne, the very first Cadillac made in 1903, and a 1925 Rolls-Royce Phantom I, which set the benchmark for luxury cars. The vault also holds political history, with three vehicles from presidential motorcades. Movie fans will recognize the car driven by the arch foe of Bond, James Bond, in Die Another Day, and Black Beauty, the Green Hornet's weapons-laden Chrysler Imperial Crown. And, although Volkswagen just announced it will end production of the classic VW Beetle next year, it lives on in the Herbie the Love Bug movies. Cheyenne Boki of Petrolicious, a digital automotive lifestyle brand, says the vault is like a time machine.
Where else are you going to find a Formula One car, lowrider, and the Chevy Ron's Bugatti in one place? So if you wanted to see these cars at an event, it would take a couple lifetimes to get them all. So seeing them all in one place is definitely a must see if you're even remotely interested in cars.
The tour gives car lovers a chance to enjoy the evolution of the industry, the art, and its history. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and while you can hear us live as we do our program every Monday through Friday, you can find it anytime you like on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can hear us streaming on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Facebook is a great way to get in touch with us, or you can email us, voaasia@voanews.com. You can hear us on the radio, like CCU Radio at National Chung Cheng University in Taipei, Taiwan. We thank everyone there who's tuned in today. And, of course, we thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.